So today on the Cycle Edition, we are grateful to have Daniel Leonore, who's from the University of Manchester, with us today. We covered his recent Nature paper on a earlier podcast. And so today we're going to talk to him kind of about the research he does in his group, a little bit about that paper, and then also getting into kind of how PhDs work in the UK versus the US and some other fun facts there. So Daniel got his PhD at the University of Sheffield in 2010. He then moved to Aachen to do a postdoc with Magnus Ruping, then did a postdoc at the Max Planck Institute with Peter Seeberger, and then moving to the University of Bristol to work with Agarwal as a research or as a researcher. And then since 2014, he's been basically pioneering his independent career and doing a really great job. Being photochemists ourselves, we really enjoy reading the work that comes out of your group. And so he was a lecturer between 2014 and 2018. In 2018, he was promoted to reader in organic chemistry. And in 2020, so this year, you were promoted to a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Manchester. So congrats on that. Congrats on an excellent career so far. And we look forward to seeing and chatting with you today.
Great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
We've been really excited to have you on. For our listeners, I don't know if they're all aware, but our first podcast covered your Nature chemistry paper that was published early in 2019. Yeah. And we were just really excited because at the time we weren't quite sure how the Cycle Edition was going to take off, if anyone was going to follow it. And we covered your paper and you promoted us on social media, which we loved. And we actually, you started using one of our slides in your talks. And we had a visiting scientist who's originally from Italy attend one of your talks one time. And he sent us a Slack message and was like, look, we see you on the screen of Leonore's talk. So it's just been really fun to follow, I guess, your engagement with us. We're excited to cover another one of your papers that recently came out, and just follow along your career. So thank you again for being here.
No, thank you for having me. That's great.
Yeah, so to start off, we'd be interested to hear just a quick introduction to yourself. So specifically, how did you get to where you are today? And what drew you to a career as a chemist?
So I mean, as you said earlier, so I come from Italy, so from a small village in the center of the country. And I don't know, just when I was a master's student, I just felt I really wanted to do a PhD. And then I think at the early stages, I really wanted to work in industry. And then when I moved to Sheffield, my PhD boss really put me this passion about academia, and that's where I felt I really wanted to be. And then it took me 4 years from the end of the PhD to get an academic job. In the UK, I'm not sure about the US, the system is very competitive. There's not many places and a lot of people applying. So it's rather difficult, and now it's even more difficult. And I think, let's say that I've been very lucky to do a lot of different things. I've done a little bit of photoredox with Magnus Ruping, which made me interested in this field, and I followed the field from the very early stages. And then I've done a little bit of biochemistry, or let's say carbohydrate chemistry with Peter Seeberger. And then I think the 2 years that I did with Agarwal have been very important for me on learning how to, you know, develop a research idea, manage a research group. So I'm very grateful from everything that I've learned when I was in Bristol. And then I guess in Manchester, I've been super lucky with my colleagues and the university. That's been very, very nice from the very early stages with the support in terms of studentships. And then I had very, very good group members from the early stages. So my very first PhD student, Jacob Davis, has been fantastic. So it's at the very early stages, it was just me and him in the lab. And that guy was just phenomenal. And then that followed with a lot of other very good people. And then some great postdocs came along, like the one of the paper that you were mentioning, Alessandro and Fabio, and also Shashi, which was in the most recent paper. So I really owe a lot to my group members. They've done a lot of stuff. So I think it's because of them, essentially. Yeah.
You mentioned that originally you were interested in industry. Does that drive, I guess, a lot of the utility behind the chemistry that you're currently publishing?
I guess so. I think I see a lot of potentials in terms of industry, and so I really like enjoying with industrialists. And interacting with them and see what they think and what they perceive is important and what they perceive is not important. So I tend to use them more as resources for where I should direct my programs. And for the moment, that's what really drives me in terms of industry.
Well, your group seems to have kind of focused on nitrogen-centered kind of chemistry, amination or nitrogen-centered radical chemistry. I think, you know, the first paper we covered was on the forming the chloroamines, doing reductive chemistry there to form nitrogen radicals. You know, this most recent paper has been on the, it was on the formation of anilines through this, you know, condensation and then alpha amino oxidation chemistry. Is that just a topic that you've been, you know, really interested in? Are you continuing down that line? And I guess really more importantly, like, how did you kind of find that field and find that that was a field that you could kind of make a discovery in?
So there's two ways of answering this question. So the nitrogen radical chemistry, that was the proposals, I mean, that chemistry was how I applied to Manchester for my job. So all the early work, the early work that we did in terms of cyclization, 1,5-HAT, all the stuff was the core of the project that I came up with 5 years ago when I applied. The rest of the stuff, like the new chemistry that we're doing, like this aniline synthesis with the cyclohexanone, that is not my idea, in all fairness. We were actually looking for something else. And Shashi was just great at spotting this strange kind of side product. And then he rationalized the way they came up, and then we built up a project and a program now on this. I guess there's always been a lot of interest in forming carbon-nitrogen bonds. This is something, you know, I was doing nitrogenetic compound during my PhD as well, so I've always been very interested in that, and we still continue to try to find ways of forming carbon-nitrogen bond, but now we are expanding to a lot of new stuff, new areas, just simply because the group is a little bit larger and people are more interested also in doing something else.
I'm curious, you know, we're really interested in this idea of problem selection and how to choose what problems to go after. You mentioned a little bit talking to people in industry, seeing what's important. What advice do you have for students that might be thinking about going into academia, or even students that are thinking about research problems now, into how to determine the best problems to go after?
So for me, that's a really great question. So I'm not sure I have an answer for this. I think it's still a learning process for me as well. For me, really, I had to learn very fast how to try to be very, very ambitious and have backup plans as well. So I don't know how the system works in the US, but in the UK, when you write a project or something like this, it's really important that you have a really blue sky vision of something very, very big that then is backed up with a sort of sideline where you have reachable goals, which could still make, you know, nice papers and nice and a nice story. I tend to use a little bit my instinct, and then also to just look at, you know, I spend a lot of time looking at industrial targets and see the way that they make them, and if there would be a disconnection that would make them much easier. And then from there, we start to brainstorm with my guys about synthesis. It doesn't work, we don't manage too often to come up with a nice solutions, but we have a lot of ideas that then, of course, they don't work because they're too ambitious and stuff like that. But I think it's good to try. And then you go down to the initial ones, which are safer. That at least is my strategy.
That's interesting. And I think that's something we've kind of found is that there's always this big, big vision that maybe a group has that is something that they want to solve, but might be, you know, it's a 10, 15, 20 year goal rather than a, you know, 1-2 year, a PhD kind of system. Do you have a goal that kind of drives you that you know, is that like in 20 years you want to have solved some big problem?
So, you know, this is a difficult thing in the way that the system forces you at the early stages to have, you know, a lot of papers and try to get grants. In order to get grants, you need to get papers. So you don't think too much in the long term, but you think about, you know, goals that you can reach within 2 or 3 years or stuff like that. At least that was for my case. I don't have a goal of a transformation that you say I want to have done that. I have a lot of interest in a lot of different reactions and disconnections that I think could be very interesting. It could lead to new chemistry. And I'm also interested in trying to see, you know, now, because there's a lot of knowledge in the past that has been neglected, or, you know, that at that time we just didn't valorize it or stuff like that. So how to relook back at old chemistry, like the enchloroamines, which were, you know, developed for the first time in the 60s, and then they just were silent for 50 years.
That seemed to be something that kind of, or at least that was something I got out of the science paper you published earlier this year with the halogen atom transfer as well. That was something that, you know, we have dealt with, you know, triethylamine in Teschik's group as a reducing agent. And like I've used it throughout my PhD as just a reductant for photocatalysts, and I never considered that style of chemistry. And so that was something that came out of that paper that was really surprising to me, was that was an old kind of idea that was known that just hadn't been ever applied before in kind of a synthetic sense. And so
yeah, so that's another project that came out of trying to do something else, and Fabio, which was the postdoc that was working on that, was just phenomenal at, I don't know how, connecting the dots in this way and spotting this halogen atom transfer, which, you know, I just didn't believe, and I still have a long tray of email of me telling him to stop the project, which, you know, it's really embarrassing now. But yeah, no, and then when we started to see this early work done by Lalave in particular, then we started to believe that that was the right reactivity, and then that led, you know, to a lot of new exciting things that we're doing now. So
moving to the paper that you just published on aniline formation, you know, we're still talking kind of about idea generation. So what was the process of coming up with that idea?
I guess you want the true answer to that. So the truth about the paper is, what we wanted to do was, we wanted to go from cyclohexanone to cyclohexanone. Okay. So we wanted to do essentially the very first step of the reaction, and that's it. We wanted to do the dehydration of an enon to form a migral acceptor. Shashi, at that in mind, was trying to convince me about doing that for, I think, 5 or 6 months. And then at the end, I gave up and said, okay, try it. And then we wanted to do it catalytic with amine. So he just did it with 20% amine, and he got out 20% yield of aniline of the reactions, which was unexpected. But as soon as he saw it, in 2 seconds, he told me, okay, we formed the enon, forms the dienamine and aromatizes. And the reaction was pretty much optimized from the first trial, really. And then when we saw the entry, we all thought, okay, this is a new kind of way of looking at this chemistry, especially because it's done at room temperature. And then we connected a little bit more dots, and we had to engineer a little bit the process, because the limitation there is not the radical chemistry or the cobalt chemistry itself, is the enamine catalysis or the enamine chemistry that takes place in that. So that was, took us a little bit of time. But then that has been probably one of the easiest projects we've worked on, because I have this strong collaboration with AstraZeneca. I collaborate with James Douglas, which was an ex-post of Corey Stephenson. And as soon as I showed him this result, James was super excited, and he told me, okay, we have to do it together. And then he was involved in the project from day one. So, but the reaction itself came up as a mistake. So we weren't looking for that, but Shashi was good enough to spot it. And then once he spotted it, it was in 2 seconds, we designed it.
Had your group been looking at cobalt catalysis before?
No, that was the very first time. So Shashi and others, they were discussing about Alessandro, the guy that was in the amination paper in the other paper. They were discussing a lot about the potentials of cobalt. We were trying for a long time to try to make anilines, using cobalt instead of forming an enchloroamine, which, you know, has some limitation, and then using all these bronzed acids, which again is not great. We tried a lot to try to find a way of just using cobalt catalysis and photoredox to couple aromatics and amines, and that never led to any good result. So we were thinking a lot about cobalt chemistry, but that was the very first time that we managed to apply in a successful reaction.
Yeah, I really, like when reading this paper, I really liked reading about cobalt and then just learning more about it, since I haven't really read many cobalt catalysis papers.
Yeah, so I mean, we are still learning a lot about this, and I mean, let's say that we tend to look at it more in the way, you know, there's a lot of papers where people have merged photoredox with cobalt. So we tend to approach it in this way, exactly in the same way. So the same reductive quenching cycles where cobalt, you know, loses hydrogen and all that kind of stuff, generate hydrogens and all that stuff. I think it would be really interesting if we could find another spin for cobalt to look at it in a different way. This is something we're looking at, but... yeah, I don't have a solution yet, yeah. But I agree with you, it's really exciting, cobalt chemistry, yeah.
So you mentioned your collaboration with AstraZeneca. What does that look like for your group? What role do you play? What role do they play when you're going after a new project?
So in the UK, the system is a little bit different in the way that it's very difficult to get PhD studentships. So one of the best way to get a studentship is if you have industrial support. An industry run these programs every year where they gave pots of monies, which are called PhD case awards. And they give essentially half of a PhD studentship, and then it's up to every chemistry department to find the money to match the funding and then make a full studentship. And then when you have something like this, it's great because it means that the student will work for you for 3 years and a half. But we'll have to spend 3 months in industry. And over the 3 years and a half, we'll always have an industrial co-supervisor. So I've been very lucky because at the early stages, I got two of the studentships, one after the other one with AstraZeneca. And the industrial supervisor was this young guy that was starting at the same time that I was starting, James. And because the AstraZeneca site is literally 30 minutes from the University of Manchester, and James is such a great guy, he's really excited, he's really passionate about chemistry. We had the nonstop interactions, like on Friday, James would just come into the university and we would stay, you know, until 7 chatting about stuff with our group, and then we'd go out for dinner. So we were having these really, really intense discussions and collaborations. And then James was able, you know, not to do the scale up and all the safety analysis of all our reactions on site in Macclesfield. Then he went to Stockholm and he did our reactions with the robotic platforms, which was really exciting. And for the Nature paper, you know, when we got the revisions, we were in lockdown. So my lab was shut, Manchester was closed. So he was able to go in the AstraZeneca labs and do all the corrections for the paper, for which I'm hugely grateful. I mean, because otherwise it would have taken us months to do that. And then James is fantastic in the way that he's very interested, not just in the process itself, but in the details. So he, in the past, he has helped us a lot with the mechanisms because of his strong background, because he comes from Cori's group. And then also, like, he tells us which are the substrate that we should try. So in all the scopes, there are always a lot of examples that come because it tells us, okay, that's something that for us would be interesting. And then he sends us something similar. And that's just, it's just really nice to have these kind of collaborations.
That was definitely something that stuck out to us when we looked at that paper and at some of your previous ones as well, is that the scopes are not your classic, you know, here's just a very simple cyclohexanone that we varied every position on, but they were keyed in towards, you know, more complex products that looked very unique and interesting. And so
yeah,
just looking at them, you could tell there was, you know, you could see the influence from AstraZeneca there, but also, you know, you could see how useful the methodology might actually be.
Yeah. So for example,
you know, sorry, go ahead.
So like, for example, something that I ignored completely, like in that paper, in the cyclohexanone scope, we did this aminated indoles and benzopyrazole and benzofuran and benzothiophenes. And I would have never considered those, but James knew that there were a program in AstraZeneca that actually failed because they couldn't do this kind of molecule. So then it was really interesting. And, you know, that's great because then you understand, you know, which is the real challenge.
That's really cool, actually. Yeah, I like that a lot. Since we're discussing kind of this, I think it's maybe we'll take a little aside here. When you have, I guess you're getting close to probably graduating, or you've just graduated your kind of first class of PhD students. Where have they gone, if you don't mind sharing? And like, you know, like when you think about that, do you think that you're trying to train them more for industry or academics or both?
Well, I try to train them so then they can do whatever they want. I mean, of course, egoistically, I would really like to have them in academia, but I understand that is not for everybody. So as long as they're happy and, you know, they feel fulfilled, that's okay with me. So Jake, my first PhD student, is now with Ruben Martin. He's at the ICIQ in Tarragona, and he has a Maritime Fellowship. Then my second postdoc my second PhD student, Tom, is in AstraZeneca in Gothenburg. My third one, Danielle, is a senior scientist in Signature, which is a biotech in Nottingham. And then my fourth PhD student is Liz, and she's a postdoc AstraZeneca in Macclesfield at the moment. And then the postdocs that have left, Sarah, she's an academic now in Spain, in Granada. And Fabio is a postdoc with Tobias Ritter at the Max Planck. He's a second postdoc, and then he wants to launch an academic position as well.
So going back to what you said earlier, I guess this kind of comes from my lack of knowledge about the European system, but you were talking about how PhD students oftentimes needed, I think you called them a studentship, right? Or some connection with industry. Can you talk about that more? Obviously that's very different from the US where we just apply to a program and get in and what's that look like?
So in the UK, the system works in this way. So every university has a little bit of money, which is given from the EPSRC, which is the Research Council, like the NHS. And they can be used to support strategical, let's say, research areas between all academics. But normally we're talking about very few studentships. So like a department, a strong department like Manchester is able every year to sponsor by himself, maybe up to 15 studentships. Okay, then the government creates around the country centers of excellence where PhD students can be trained just in one area. So for example, Bristol as a center for doctoral training in chemical synthesis, Cambridge as a center for doctoral training in artificial intelligence associated to chemistry. In Manchester, we have one in integrated catalysis, which is biocatalysis, photocatalysis, chemocatalysis, and all these things. So this is another stream that allow us to get PhD students. But then there's not many other ways of getting a PhD student in your group unless you have the interest of a pharmaceutical company or an agrochemical company, or if you have funding, unrestricted funding from, for example, the Leverhulme Trust or the European Research Council. So it's not as easy to get PhD students, I've been very lucky so far,
When a student is an undergraduate and thinking about going to graduate school, do they still apply to each of these university programs and worry about funding later, or how does that process work?
Yeah, so you cannot apply, so they can only apply to open positions which are already funded. So we don't have, unfortunately, we don't have a fellowship scheme where, you know, excellent candidates could apply for their own fellowship and then start a PhD. So they only apply to positions where the funding to the PI has been already guaranteed. And those are all online, and they just apply. So there's a lot of openings. I mean, in the UK, because it's a strong system, it's a lot of money, it's not guaranteed that I can have a PhD student every single year. That's the key message.
It sounds more like a job application than a kind of like, you know, going, you know, applying to go to school.
Yes. So it's not seen as a grad school like it's in the US. So there's no lectures, They don't do any teaching assistantship jobs. They start in the lab from day one, and it's 3 years and a half of lab work, and that's it. There's a little bit of lab demonstrations for the undergrads, but that's a very minor duty. It's just lab, yeah.
That was, yeah, very similar. I spent a year in Sweden, and it was similar to kind of their program there. Yes. The question went in and out of my brain. Do most of your students come in already completing a master's as well, or do you go straight from you're getting your bachelor's into a PhD?
So you can do a BSc and then potentially you can start to get a PhD and then start a PhD. In Cambridge, for example, they don't do masters. I personally recruit only students that have already done the master, simply because they at least have had a little bit of practical skills and have, you know, studied a little bit more advanced concept in organic chemistry. And so I feel that they have a little bit more background to then, you know, start a little bit better in the group and, you know, not have a problem of learning techniques or stuff like that.
I think it's, clearly we don't have a great understanding of the UK system, but do you have any advice for prospective students, whether they're PhDs or postdocs from America or really anywhere outside of the UK who might be interested in doing?
Yeah, so I guess, you don't know, something that's clear in the UK is that the timing is very important. So you have to be very good with the timing in the way, you know, that for a PhD studentship starting, for example, in October 2021, good people start to apply now for positions. So from now to January, that's when we fill all our openings. So, you know, I receive a lot of great applicants, you know, maybe in August asking me to start in a couple of months. And there's no way that, you know, I've already filled all the openings. So I think you have to understand that the timing, it might be a little bit different than other places. So it's good to apply always ahead of time, especially for a PhD studentships. And for a postdoc, you can try to send just a blank email to an academic because you really like his job. I would try to understand his funding sources, because unless you have a large grant like the ERC starting grant or the ERC consolidator grant or advanced grant, this kind of stuff, every single postdoc opening is always advertised as soon as it's available. And they're always advertised on one website called jobs.ac.uk. So everything goes through that. And that's the main source, together with the single website for openings. Yes, I think for postdocs, there's a lot of flexibility. For PhD students, you have to apply early at the beginning of the previous academic year. That's my advice.
I think that part sounds similar. So undergraduates apply to US institutions in the fall, and then they're usually accepted January, February. And then each program takes them on like a visit, and they might be accepted to 5 schools, depending on how many they applied to, and you can visit the schools and see, talk with the professors and see what it's like. Do you have any programs like that in the UK, or is it really more like a job application?
So I would say it's a job application. So you don't apply for the department or for the grad school, you apply for the PI. Okay, so you send an application. If that person is interested, normally arranges an interview. And the interview can be done by Skype, by Zoom. I mean, I always prefer to invite people on site, even if they're coming from France or from Spain, simply because I think it's very important to have a feeling for the person to have a feeling on what the place looks like, and also for you. And then of course you can apply to multiple places and get multiple offers and then choose the one that you like. But normally, like if I would receive an application and I would be interested in the applicant, I would invite him to come to Manchester. I would have an interview for the person, but that person will not necessarily meet, you know, any of my colleagues unless he had already contacted him, and we agreed on having, you know, a shared interview.
So I'm interested in asking you one more research question before we completely move on from that. But even aside from your research, in terms of the field of photocatalysis, where do you see that going in the next 10 or 15 years? What are the big challenges that we still have to solve as a field, in your opinion?
That's a great question. It's a difficult one because, you know, I think if we knew exactly which was the big questions coming up in 10 years, we would try to solve it right now and not wait for 10 years. But for me, selectivity is the key issue. So how to get selectivity out of the reactions, and that can mean a lot of things. Can be, you know, an stereoselectivity, or, you know, in terms of asymmetric synthesis. I'm not too interested in that personally. It's just a preference. In my opinion, it's more selectivity, for example, on sp3 ch bond functionalization, something that really excites me, how to achieve that, or new ways of looking, generating synthetic intermediates using catalysis, and how to switch the reactivity of system. But for me, it will be more a matter of selectivity. Something that really excites me is, you know, now try to find ways that display different selectivity from mainstream reactivities that everybody uses all the time, like CH activation or cross-coupling. But that's where I see, and of course the interplay with biology, I think it'll be massive, you know, integrating photocatalysis with biocatalysis. I think it's really exciting and something that I cannot contribute to it, unfortunately, because I don't have the background, but it's something they always look forward to when I see these papers coming out.
That's great. Yeah, I think those are those are fields that I think also interest us a good bit. Being in Teshik's group, we do like our asymmetric catalysis, but we are all still thinking too about kind of targeting, you know, CH bonds that are far away from functional groups and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll try and wrap up with maybe some more fun questions that are just more about you and kind of what you and your group do for either for fun or just kind of around Manchester. So, like, you know, kind of the first is, like, do you or your group have kind of like a favorite place that y'all go in Manchester when you have some downtime?
So we have a lot of places that we like to go. I guess what I like doesn't really match what my group like. So I really like to go to the 10K and the half marathon, you know, running events in Manchester. And sometimes I forced my group to come with me, and that has been quite nice. I guess in Manchester, if I would have to say, so we really like to have publication parties. To me, those are some of the moments I had the most fun with my group, when a paper comes out and then we have a room that we can use in the department, and then we arrange like a nice party with, you know, a lot of nice food, a lot of nice drinks. And we tend to stay sometimes late and have discussions, sometimes about chemistry, sometimes about life. So that probably for me is the best place to interact with my group, yeah.
You mentioned running, and last year, Matt and I and another group or a person from our department all did a half marathon, and we tried to get Teshik to do it, but he was conveniently on sabbatical, so yeah. He did not participate.
So what was your time then?
Oh, not good. Matt would be better.
No, I was really slow too. We did a half marathon. I've never done a full marathon. Maybe someday. Under 2 hours, but not by much. So it was a slow jog for me.
That's really good. So I've been trying. So every year I try to have a group retreat, and so I do a little bit of CrossFit. I'm completely rubbish at it, but I persevere. And the plan was I was trying to book the gym for my group to do a session all together, and then it went all up in smoke because of the COVID. But this is something I want to do with my group as well. Yeah, something more athletic, let's say that.
What do you normally do for your group retreat?
So last year we all went to Spain for 3 days in the south, where the weather is very nice. And the idea was that, so I paid for everything, and apart from the drinks. And we would have the mornings always free to relax. And then in the afternoon was a series of presentation and everybody had to prepare a 30-minute talk on a project that was not related to what we were doing for future work. So essentially I was trying to pay to get their ideas and it worked really well. It was really cool. We had a swimming pool and a barbecue. So it was really cool.
Sounds pretty great. Don't know if you're a soccer fan, Manchester City or Manchester United?
AC Milan, always.
Oh man, fair enough.
But if I would have to choose, I would go with United.
I'm sorry.
you're a City fan or?
I am, which, you know, I don't know how much any American can really be a huge fan of the Premier League, but I do like to watch it a little bit.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're going to enjoy it, yeah.
Thank you amazingly for this opportunity to have you on, and we've really enjoyed it. We've enjoyed interacting with you over social media as the podcast has grown. So thank you very much.
Great, thanks guys. Good luck with everything.